Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a video and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Today, it is my privilege to welcome a very, very successful and a senior naval officer, Commodore C. Uday Bhaskar, to the show. Commodore Bhaskar, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Commodore Bhaskar is a retired naval officer and one of India's leading experts and outspoken critics on security and strategic affairs. He's the director of the Society for Policy Studies, an independent think tank. He's a columnist, editor, and contributor of numerous research articles on nuclear and international security issues. And I see him all the time on various television channels. So, sir, tell me, what would you say are three key milestones in your career or life?
Three key milestones in my own life?
Yes.
I'm not quite sure as to how...
We'll start with you personally.
Thank you, Ashutosh, for inviting me to your show. And it's very generous of you, the kind of introduction you've given me. But let me just add that I am a retired naval officer. Mm-hmm. A Commodore is a mid-level rank, so I do not want to overstate that. And in terms of my own, I would say, milestones for me personally, I think the fact that I was able to join the NDA in 1966 was a very important personal milestone, because in a way it shaped and gave me a certain career path.
Okay.
I'm always very, I would say, conscious and grateful to the NDA in Parakwaslan and all my peers of my course, the 36th course of the NDA. The second, I would say, major milestone for me personally was that when I was in the Navy, as a young commander, I was given an opportunity to join the Institute for Defense Studies and Analysis, the IDSA.
Okay.
Which in those days used to be in Sapru House, and our former director, Mr. K. Subramaniam, who alas is no more, he and Air Commodore Jasjit Singh, they were my immediate, I would say, mentors and my bosses at different points in time. I think that was a very, very important situation and a milestone for me.
Yeah.
And if I could just add one more element, which I think is very important in my own personal trajectory, I think it was a decision taken by my wife to be. At that time, we were not yet married.
Okay.
But my wife's name is Ira Bhaskar. She is currently a professor at JNU.
Okay.
Sometime in 79-80, when she decided that, you know, we would enter into a formal relationship as marriage. I think that is really significant, because your question did throw me a bit. I've never been asked to identify three milestones, but I thought I should flag these.
Fair enough. So now let me come back to the area that, you know, you do research on, you speak about. Let's speak about China. You know, you are a China expert. I'm not an expert, but from the corporate world, I've been to China at least 50 or 60 times. So I've followed that country fairly closely. So what, you know, do you think is behind China's age-old philosophy of expansionism?
You know, China's orientation, especially I think in the current context, we in India are dealing with the tension on the line of actual control in Ladakh. That is the most recent manifestation.
Correct.
But as a student of China for many years now, I would say that there is a very distinctive characteristic of China's strategic culture, which is embedded, I think, in the leadership, in the elite of China, who have been managing the affairs of China for well over 2,000 to 3,000 years, depending on where we want to date the beginning of China. There's no doubt that it is an ancient civilization, like India. It's also become a modern nation state.
Correct.
But it has a certain self-image about territoriality and also about China's own place under the sun. It's a complex subject, but in summary, if we were to use the Twitter methodology, I would say that the characteristic is one of a certain envisioned contour of the motherland. So there is a geographic kind of vision of China and the motherland, and the current dispensation led by President Xi Jinping have taken this almost as a sacred divine calling that they have to restore whatever they believe is the contour of the motherland. And therefore, all the expansions, I would say, developments we have seen over the last 30, 40 years, it's not just India and the LAC. It is China, Japan. It is China, Taiwan.
Correct.
It is China, ASEAN. It is China, Myanmar. You know, you can go around China.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you will find that they have a certain vision that they now want to reclaim.
Correct.
So I see this embedded in their history and their culture.
And if you look at, you know, the three key leaders, if I can use that term, of China have been Mao, Deng and Xi. I mean, they positioned themselves as the three main chairmen of the Communist Party. Mao insisted on taking over Tibet because he had to show that he has taken over a very large amount of territory. Deng Xiaoping, and I've had the opportunity to hear him live in Beijing, used to believe in growth with folded hands. And Xi Jinping believes in checkbook diplomacy. What is your view on the differences between these three powerful leaders of China?
Well, first of all, I would say that, again, as an analyst, I think my own perspective on China would be very contextual, meaning that any interpretation of China cannot ignore the time-space context. So in that sense, I think whether you look at ancient China, you look at medieval China, you look at a colonized China, or you look at a post-49 China, I think that context is important. And I think each of them, Chairman Mao, of course, consolidated China after 1949, the Great March, the post-World War II rebuilding. And he had to live with the, I would say at one level, the challenge of Taiwan and the KMT.
Correct.
And the fact that he was at that time a new leader. China was not an easy country to consolidate, especially after the war and not just World War II, but the Civil War. And all the, you know, I would say, anguish that they went through in that period, the whole decade of the 40s up to 1949.
Right.
So I think his style of functioning, he made big blunders. There's no doubt about it.
Correct.
But in his lifetime, I think Chairman Mao made China pay a very heavy price.
Correct.
For the consolidation that he was able to bring about, whether it is the Red Book, the Cultural Revolution, the millions of Chinese who died because of the famine. I mean, there were convulsions that he imposed on China because of his own certitude on a number of issues. But historically, if we were to look at the profile of China from 1949 onwards, Mao is very much, I would say, the man who consolidated communist China.
Correct.
As I said, he made the people of China pay with their lives and blood. But he gave it a certain template. And that, I think, is his contribution.
Okay.
Chairman Deng, I think, was a very, very different person. You use the phrase that growth with folded hands. There was a certain innate pragmatism about Deng Xiaoping, who I think was able to recognize the opportunity and the challenge when he came to power. And please remember that his was not an easy transition.
Correct.
It's not as if he was a consensus candidate. He almost, I would say, slipped on many banana peels.
Correct.
And it is a tribute to his, I would say, acumen, political acumen, that he survived and he was able to lead China in a very low profile manner. But yet, while he put it on the path of economic, I would say, liberalization, and doesn't matter what color the cat is as long as it catches mice, you know, that whole kind of philosophy.
Correct.
He was also a very ruthless man. That's the only way, I presume, you survive in the politics of China.
Absolutely.
And my illustration is Tiananmen. June 1989, the way in which Chairman Deng Xiaoping, who often said that his only formal position is the president of the Bridge Association of China, was a very ruthless leader. He he was able to deal with Tiananmen. We can have a debate about whether or not it was the right thing. But the fact is, when the Cold War was ending, China was going through its own internal convulsions. And to his credit, Mr. Deng Xiaoping gave China that stability which it needed. And in many ways, I don't know whether we'll have time to get into that, but I often think of Mr. P.V. Narasimha Rao, our former Prime Minister, when I think of Chairman Deng, but that's a different story altogether. And the last is, of course, Chairman now, in lighter way, and I call him Emperor, Xi Jinping. He's Emperor for life. He brings a completely different, I would say, personal trait characteristic to the office that he's now holding. And we know that he's also moving with great resolve. Whether he succeeds or not, I think the jury is still out. Today, as we are speaking, the party congress is going on. And maybe in the next day or two, we will have a better sense about the degree to which Mr. Xi Jinping is able to realize his own personal agenda, including the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, and various other things. And LAC and India, I think, is part of that larger Xi persona.
Fantastic. So this is a fantastic segue into a discussion on Xi Jinping. Very powerful leader, has voted himself in for life. And I was fascinated to learn that, like Mao's Red Book, which you spoke about, there is a similar book that has been written for Xi Jinping. And every school teacher is now required to have the learnings or the teachings of Xi Jinping on their table. And so it's like an indoctrination going on. What could be driving one of the most powerful people of China into opening up flanks around in 14 countries around China, including the LAC, of course? Is it because there are problems within the country which he is trying to cover up? Is it to stir up national feelings? Your thoughts, sir?
Well, you're right about President Xi Jinping being currently the most powerful man in China.
Yes, sir.
And even in terms of his predecessors, whether it is Mr. Hu Jintao or Mr. Jiang Zemin, he has, in a way, accorded unto himself various levers of power apart from the military commission, the party congress, and being general secretary and president. If you remember the Bo Xilai story, you know, I was in China at that time on a conference visit. And I was quite struck by the manner in which I think this entire Bo Xilai incident was addressed. And I remember talking to some of my Chinese friends, academics, and so on.
Sorry to interrupt, but for our viewers, could you talk about the Bo Xilai incident?
Bo Xilai, very briefly, I would say, is about a person who was seen as a rival to Mr. Xi Jinping. And before the nomination of Mr. Xi Jinping as the general secretary in the party congress under Mr. Hu Jintao, Bo Xilai was seen as this very charismatic leader, and he was able to do things, and he was a coastal Chinese person, and he had great business acumen. And he also had a certain relationship, as they say, with some women. So all of this added to the flamboyance about the man. And at that crucial juncture, the Chinese sort of system leveled charges not only of murder, but, you know, corruption and various other, I would say, transgressions. And the long and short is that he was put through the equivalent of a kangaroo court. And we haven't heard of him since then. And in many ways, a rival to Xi Jinping was eliminated. By that time, I remember raising this, trying to understand China, governance, politics, etc. And I was talking to a few of my friends, both in China and China experts in other parts of the world. And we were having a drink in the evening and we were chatting. And I said, listen, it clearly is a case of, you know, now Mr. Bo Xilai and his own clique or his own faction have all been removed. And it's a case of, you know, there is no body that is left on the floor. And one of my Chinese academics said, you know, that you don't understand Chinese politics at the very top.
Right.
Forget about bodies. There'll be nothing left. There is no body. There is no blood. The knives are out and the man has disappeared. And he disappears even from the discourse. And I think that is the most, I would say to me, relevant characteristic of Mr. Xi Jinping's resolve. His anti-corruption drive, the way in which he's dealt with his critics. And this book that you're referring to is, in a way, to me again, enshrining his thought. My sense is that if he realizes all his objectives, he will displace Mao.
Correct.
In the hierarchy of Chinese leadership. And I think everything points in that direction.
Amazing. So, you know, again, I was reading that there seems to be a lot of dissonance in the ranks of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as in the army, because suddenly succession has been stopped completely because now there's a leader for life. What have you heard about this, sir?
Again, I've also picked up similar kind of, I would say, signals and some little strands that seem to suggest a certain discord, which is very deep. It is there in the party. It is there in the military, because if you remember, in the last 3-4 years, there's been ostensibly a relentless anti-corruption drive. But apparently, the anti-corruption drive is only a kind of packaging for certain leaders who have seemed to be either critical of Mr. Xi Jinping or seem to be closer to his potential rivals.
Okay.
So in that sense, it is the party, it is the military, and even people in the equivalent of the Chinese corporate world, all of them are closely aligned with the government. But anyone who stepped out of line, you'll recall, in the last 1 year, we've had 2 or 3 incidents of very, very well-to-do Chinese who, because they were critical of the leadership, have been, in a way, made to pay a certain price. So I think there is what I would call as this discord, this dissonance, the word that you use. And even academics who are normally very circumspect, if you read, actually, you know, to me, Ashutosh, I would say that reading the Chinese media in Chinese gives you a very good insight into some of the discourses that are taking place. And it's very elliptical. A lot of signaling goes on. They go back into Chinese history, philosophy. They talk about legends. And you can make out that they're, I mean, this is my reading.
Yeah.
I'm a student and I just picked up some strands. But I broadly agree with you that there is a certain dissonance.
Very interesting. So, sir, now let's talk a little bit about India and China and what's happening in the line of actual control. But my first question is, how relevant is India in China's scheme of things? I mean, China's looking at being the second largest economy in the world, the big powerhouse. How relevant is India for them?
Well, I think India will always be the equivalent of the other in China's larger, I would say, both regional and worldview. And part of this is geography. You know, China cannot wish India away. India cannot wish China away.
Correct.
We are yoked by geography. The Himalayas, the land masses, etc., etc. I'm saying that geography. And the second is history. Both India and China are civilizational state. They have been brought into their modern nation state avatar, if you will, in 47 and 49 respectively. But they are both very complex. They are very prickly. They have a certain, I would say, self-image, which they are now trying to realize in different ways. I have long maintained, Ashutosh, again, as a student of China, that India, in a way, you know, places China in an intellectual kind of, I would say, state of anxiety. Now, this may seem odd for me to say this, you know, given the fact that the comprehensive power differential is so high in China's favor. But my brief, I haven't made 50 visits to China, I may have made 10. But my visits to China and my conversations with them in the 2 or 3 cities that I visited, the discerning Chinese, the thinking Chinese, the reading Chinese, those who have applied their mind, acknowledge the intellectual, spiritual, philosophical kind of contribution that India has made to Chinese thought. And this is the whole, I would say, Buddhist influence and how that's been internalized. China values certain, you know, philosophical and, you know, certain traits which are intangible. For that, India is seen as a source.
Okay.
But at the same time, modern China, and this is my formulation, sees India as the democratic experiment, which challenges the core principles of the Communist Party.
Very well said. Okay.
And therefore, I think the relevance of India is in this intangible. And then, of course, the first issue that we discussed was expansionism and territory. China has this view about Tibet, about Taiwan, about Xinjiang, and now, of course, their claims on Ladakh and Arunachal and the unresolved territorial dispute. All of this makes India, I think, relevant. And the most recent, I would say, trigger is the proximity between India and the United States. For a variety of reasons, of which the Pompeo Esper visit is only the most recent exemplar.
Correct. So a follow-up question to that, sir, would be, where does Pakistan fit into China's scheme of things? I mean, is it an irritant for China? Is it the access that the CPEC is going to provide to China to the Middle Eastern waters? Or is it something else?
Well, first of all, I would say Pakistan is very relevant to China's overall, I would say, objectives and whatever it has envisioned for itself. And again, it is part geography and mostly the politics or geopolitics of the current time. Pakistan's relevance, in my reading of the Sino-Pak relationship, it becomes more visible after the birth of Bangladesh. You know, when we talk about how China has perceived India, we are familiar with the first decade, you know, roughly 40s, 50s, up to 62. We had Chiang Kai, we had Mao, we had Nehru, and a sense that there was some Asian solidarity that could, you know, be in a way nurtured. It did not happen.
Yes, sir.
And between Nehru and Mao, I would say the Nehruvian kind of idealism floundered on 62. Post 62, I think both countries were internally consolidating. But the way in which India enabled the birth of Bangladesh, I think that was an eye-opener for Beijing. And suddenly you saw that they were taking India more seriously, because shorn of all the identities, you know, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, partition, etc., the objective clinical military reality is, after World War II, till the end of the Cold War, no country has managed to dismember a neighbor as effectively as India did. Now, it was enabled by, I would say, the folly of the Pakistan army, the genocide and all those other things that we know about in East Pakistan.
True.
But if I was a general sitting in China or a political leader, you suddenly become aware of this neighbor who has, in a way, made two Pakistans. But after 71, and of course, there is a global geopolitics, the rapprochement between the United States and China through Pakistan and the geography of Pakistan. And the beginning of the strategic cooperation between China and Pakistan, to the extent, Ashutosh, that China does something unprecedented. They give them a nuclear weapon. They carry out a secret test.
Correct.
In 1990 and encourage and allow Pakistan to use its missile and nuclear capability against India to enhance the terrorism front. China is fully aware of this. So I have in my own writing said that China has introduced nuclear weapon enabled terror, NWET.
Okay.
And that this was in a way very irresponsible for a major power to use the nuclear shield to allow another country like Pakistan to engage in terrorism. And this is part of, I would say, the DNA of the China-Pakistan relationship.
Very interesting, sir. And my last question to you, sir. Given the current scenario at the line of actual control, what is your prognosis on where things are going to head in the next 6 months or post the winter?
Well, very briefly, I can see that I should give short answers. But the short answer is that I think the India-China relationship,
sir,
which has had some very distinct phases, after the Zhang Zemin Narasimha Rao agreement, 1993 onwards, we had a very anomalous situation. You have an unresolved border territory for 4,000 kilometers almost. Troops are in proximity when they are patrolling. But yet, as Mr. Fernandez, I accompanied him once to China, you know, said in one of his speeches there, not a shot was fired in anger from 1993 up to June 2020. With Galwan, with India losing 20 of its troops in that so-called scuffle,
sure,
I think the relationship has now been, to use Dr. Jayashankar's phrase, profoundly disturbed.
Okay.
In the end of October, as we are speaking, there is no modus vivendi between India and China along the line of active control. I expect that it will be a sullen relationship for some months up to the next summer, because the winter will make it difficult for both sides to do anything operationally.
Correct.
And I think this party congress, which is going on just now, will give us some idea about how China wants to proceed.
Right.
As also the November 3 election in the United States.
Absolutely.
But I think that's a very critical indicator whether we have a second Trump term or we have Mr. Joe Biden, in which case I think the US-China relationship would have a bearing on the India-China relationship and the NAC.
Very well said. Gaurav Bhaskar, thank you so much, sir. It was such a pleasure speaking to you. I mean, there is so much of a wealth of knowledge you have. Maybe I'll come back to you and ask you to do a more detailed chat on another subject of China. I'm grateful for the time you've taken. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.